Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest this week has a work resume that challenges belief, but I know it to be true. In one life, Sean O'Keefe has been the head of NASA, a deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget, secretary of the Navy, and the comptroller and CFO of the Defense Department. But that's just government service. He's also a former chairman of the board and CEO of Airbus, a vice president at General Electric, and the chancellor of Louisiana State University. Currently, Sean O'Keefe holds the Fansteel Chair in Strategic Management and Leadership at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Grant. Good to be with you.
It's good to have you here. So first things first, congratulations on LSU's football national championship.
That was quite an achievement. It was the perfect season with a national championship and a Heisman Trophy winner on top. You know, you can't get any better than that.
Were you at the game?
I was not. No. I was there when they won the national championship in 2008 as chancellor, and I thought trying to relive that experience would be impossible.
Well, you know, it's funny. The game actually leads me, strangely enough, directly into the topic of politics, as the president and the first lady made an appearance at the game. It sounds like they were warmly welcomed there. That may be sort of his geographical base in a way, but I wanted to spend some time to tap your perspective and thoughts about the Trump presidency in different ways, and also about recent politics more generally, given your experience in prior Republican presidential administrations. So let's start most recently, and then we can work our way backward and more generally. Let me start with the drone attack that killed General Soleimani. As Secretary of the Navy and head of NASA, you were part of the security establishment. So much has been made of the administration's explanation of the threat that they were responding to and the apparent lack of detail in the information that they have been providing to the public and to Congress about that. Does that strike you as unusual, first of all?
Absolutely. This was the very most charitable way you could describe the explanations that have emerged since the time this occurred. It was an evolving story. That's the most charitable way you could describe it. In my mind, there is no redeeming feature about Soleimani to begin with. This is a guy who is a really, really world stage bad actor, no doubt about that. That said, there are a lot of ways you go about the process of trying to neutralize what that conflict could be. And this was one in which we've heard repetitive different stories about it after the fact. And consultation up front would have been helpful, let's put it that way.
What about this idea that, there's been an experience trying to provide information to Congress, or there's evidence that Congress has in the past, I'm thinking of some of the witnesses during the impeachment hearings, you know, that this information will be leaked out, that there was, you know, according, you know, on the administration side, well, there's a reason to think that we had to be careful with that. You don't buy that.
I have never witnessed that in my time. In circumstances in which you're dealing with the chairs and the ranking members of the committees of jurisdiction, intelligence committees, et cetera, this is not a habit that they get into. They are very careful about dealing with information. And that's what those particular leadership positions are all about. So that's been a tested formulation. If this was a doubt about that, it would have been among the very most rare times in which it would have ever occurred. I'm having a hard time really accepting that argument.
And is there anything else about the drone attack itself or the developments that came out of it afterwards from Iran and more generally around the world that really strike you, you know, stick with you?
The most glaring observation, I guess, is that the public reaction that was so negative and so very much opposed to and quite visceral about Americans and the U.S. position on this matter changed within a span of 72 hours to exactly the opposite in opposition to the Iranian leadership for having stalled in its 3 days that it took for them to fess up, if you will, to the fact that, yes, indeed, they were responsible for the shoot down of the Ukrainian airliner. So, you know, this in both circumstances, you can draw the parallel that if the story is constantly changing after the fact, you will never regain control of it again. And that's an object lesson that's been learned time and again, and it isn't unique to us. It's unique to anybody in the world.
So Congress is pushing back against the president's actions here, and should be said we're talking on Thursday. Lots can change, but it looks like it may indeed ultimately pass a resolution. To at least at the resolution level, to limit his actions in Iran. Now, that resolution won't have the power of law, and it doesn't – I can't imagine it would survive a veto. But still, you know, it's a statement. Do you think that was necessary in this instance?
Oh, this is – again, this is the utility of consultation with Congress, with the leadership of Congress, of the appropriate committees and – the leadership within the House and Senate always is a good way to avoid this kind of reaction, because this is as old as, you know, we can in modern history, certainly reaches back to the Vietnam era, in which the War Powers Act has been repetitively raised as a proposition that the Congress, by constitutional provision, is the only branch of government that has the authority to declare war. Now, that said, there's a lot of things you can do to protect and should do as executive, the president, to protect the population that is short of going to war, but that would involve armed forces for the purpose of protecting the American people. That's what the debate's been about endlessly. And this is just yet another chapter in that saga that is avoidable by that consultation process. And not only that, but everybody tends to be more on the same page and is talking about the same story when it actually happens. You get a twofer out of that.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Syracuse University professor and former George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush administration official, Sean O'Keefe. All right, so let's turn to impeachment. So many questions to ask you here, but let me just start with a real basic one. Do you think the House Democrats did the right thing?
Absolutely. No question. I think the determination of the actions on the part of a president of the United States to not only invite but to ask openly for a foreign leader to engage in any investigative activity, forget about the fact that it's one of his political opponents, is just not the behavior of the president of the United States we want to see demonstrated. Now, whether this rises to the level of a conviction and removal of off from office is an entirely different matter. But I think a statement that this is not the kind of behavior we want to see, you know, exhibited by the president. Much the same manner as 20 years earlier, we in an impeachment proceeding determined that we do not want to see a president of the United States perjure himself before a federal grand jury. And that's what Bill Clinton did. So these are two very clear, stark circumstances in which this is what the founders had in mind, is a proposition in which we can express, not as a legal matter per se, it's less about that, it's a whole lot more about a political matter, that determines the will of the people in terms of the behavior we want to see exhibited by the president of the United States. And in both of those cases, I'd say those were justifiable positions.
So let's take the second part of that question then, the removal of office. First of all, what are the chances that two-thirds of the Senate are going to vote to remove Donald Trump from office?
Hovering near zero.
It seems to be the consensus.
Yeah, well, you've got to move, you know, better than a dozen members of the Republican majority to support such a position, assuming all the members of the minority, the Democrats, would vote in favor of conviction, as well as the independents who align with the Democrats. So this is it's a tall order, and it was intended to be a tall order. And again, the founders had in mind the proposition that, again, impeachment is It's a majority. You make a determination of, is this behavior by a factor of one? 50% plus one will do it. To make that kind of a decision about what we think is behavioral. And then as a matter of consequence, you ought to make the bar really high.
Mm.
And this is the supermajority, two-thirds of the members in the United States Senate, 67 members of the 100 must vote in favor of removal. Andrew Johnson was the only one that got anywhere near that.
And it got close.
By one.
So let's just take the politics of all this in the end. Do you think ultimately this move by Congress is going to help or hurt the president win reelection?
You could teach this round or flat. You know, I mean, yeah. Either direction, and the both parties will use it to their advantage to argue whatever the talking points are going to be to support that point of view. So I don't know that's necessarily going to be dispositive to either side. I think what is going to be – if anything, it's reinforcing to those who were already part of the faithful right. of that point of view versus another. I think it is instructive, though, for the rest of us, to those of us within the citizenry, to make a determination about what do we think of, first, that behavior. Do we want to see that ever, you know, tolerated again? Is there any other mechanism to provide a consequence for that form of behavior and then act on that in time? Mm-hmm. So that's creating a pretty robust debate for that, and we're seeing elements of that emerging within the discussion, even in terms of the terms of how the Senate trial will be conducted, which is a good idea.
Here's one thing I've heard I wanted to get your take on. If this vote in the Senate is as down the party line as it was in the House, does that not help the president in his narrative of this is just, you know, partisan politics, this is partisan payback, there's nothing more to it than that?
Well, could be. The impeachment proceedings 20 years ago with Bill Clinton was dominantly mm-hmm. the Democratic majority of that time was of the mind that Democratic members of that time were of the mind that this was not a convictable offense, and therefore voted in mass mm-hmm. to oppose that proposition. That's precisely the argument they used. They said the Republicans went too far. Same argument's going to be whipsawed back the other way by the Republicans versus the Democrats this time. So, you know, past is prologue yet again.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sean O'Keefe. He's held a number of positions in past Republican presidential administrations and currently holds the Fan Steele Chair in Strategic Management and Leadership at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Sean, I don't know whether it's possible to do what I'm about to ask you, but I want to try. If you can, strip away and leave out of your consideration President Trump's communication style, his inflammatory rhetoric, and his tweeting, okay? Just focus on the policy and his work with Congress. How would you say this administration compares with past Republican administrations? Does it look a lot different or not?
I think there are a couple of signature policy issues that that the Trump administration has pursued and done so successfully as it pertains to the tax code. Whether you like the results of that or oppose the results of that, they were effective in accomplishing that task. That's not an easy feat. It's done rarely because it's so hard to do, and it's difficult to go back and reach a consensus over what the tax code ought to look like. So that was achieved, and that's a remarkable kind of effort all by itself. Now, I don't know that that's going to sustain itself beyond this administration, but nonetheless, it is something that is a legislative accomplishment that the administration championed. I think arguably some of the objectives of regulatory reform have yielded some real positive results, some negative ones as well. But at the same time, this has been a debate that's been underway in Republican and Democratic administrations now for, gosh, it's been around the 30 years that I've been aware of, on how far or how fast or how deep, the federal government ought to tell us what to do and how the process ought to be organized for everything we're engaged in. Some say it ought to be a lot, and others say it should be very little. And this is one in which they've reached a pretty large swath of just standard kind of regulatory issues and have made some inroads at really diminishing things that, frankly, folks had forgotten the real reason why some of the regulations were set up in the first place. So they've cleared a lot of underbrush, and that is an administrative management achievement that I think, the administration set the tone for, and several of the folks within the administration effectively accomplished by working with Congress to actually get to that goal. And given the fact this is not a clear majority on both sides, that's quite an achievement all by itself, too.
What about – so I'm going to infer from what you said that the tax bill probably is the single best accomplishment. And I recognize the brackets you're putting around that idea of accomplishment.
Most notable. Whether it's best or not
right.
is a matter of judgment.
Fair enough. What would you say is the most notable, then, blunder, mistake that it's made policy-wise?
From a foreign policy standpoint, there have been so many you just can't even begin to count anymore. We've managed to do our level best to alienate all our friends and to coddle all of our adversaries in ways that has just defied any kind of foreign policy agenda that we have ever been involved with before. I think, I've heard friends who've talked about, at least we broke the mold with the North Korea negotiations. To what end? Hmm. It has resulted in nothing, and if anything, we've merely empowered a tyrant who is now getting pretty fond of the idea of being able to talk to any world leader he'd like, whereas previously that was simply not something accepted because it was so far afield in terms of the North Korean behavior that we could have imagined. So if anything, we've exacerbated problems. Certainly in Iran, that's been exactly the same situation. So we've walked away from Syria, completely disregarded every element of influence that we have within the Middle East in this regard. And I think this is a compounding set of problems that we're going to spend a long time unraveling. So in that regard, I can't think of a signature achievement. Plenty of notable disasters.
Well, let me ask you a different possible one here, and this one is more in the weeds, I think. But I think it's important. It's about how people view public service and their willingness to work in public service and work for the government. There's a challenge right now. It's a long-term one of that workforce getting older and not replenishing itself and having a tough time recruiting new talent. You've got now a president who doesn't have a lot of kind things to say about that realm and that devoting your life to that. You've spent a lot of your life in public service. Do you see a crisis here coming for public service and the notion about devoting one's life to that kind of work?
Absolutely. No, I think I concur entirely with your summary of the challenge we're dealing with. We're looking at an aging workforce now. It is now not just this administration, but the previous one, really throttled back a lot on recruiting new, energetic, enthusiastic members of the public service who would serve us as citizens. And in replacing all those vacancies, they've let them simply either go vacant or ignore them. And that's been true for the last decade. So
that's one of the things E.J. Dionne took President Obama to task for, actually, not paying enough attention to the public service. But I'm sorry, go ahead, finish your thought.
And that's exactly where we are. So both the incumbent as well as his predecessor have done a miserable job of really the responsibility of managing the primary implementation function of how policy is administered in the United States. So you know, every time any citizen gets you know, irritated with the treatment they're getting from any, you know, social agency or anywhere else across the federal government, you usually point to the, you know, all the indifference over the past decade in dealing with this. So that part, I think, is absolutely true. And it's getting to the stage where within the next 5 years or so, a staggering percentage, approaching 35-40% of all federal employees are going to be eligible to retire at that stage, which is just really an aging workforce at this point. I think the other thing that is problematic about that too, though, and independent of whether it's an activist or an indifferent, you know, attitude about whether I'm not paying enough attention to it or I actively want to keep people away from federal service, this really does deny us as citizens this whole new generation of energetic, creative, innovative people who are coming up with new solutions to old problems. We've decided we don't want to hear them by not having that infusion constantly. And I find it just really, really, you know, challenging to speak to the next generation of citizens, of Americans who want to be in capacities that can serve the public, who do not view working for the government as worth their time. Mm-hmm. They'd rather go work for a company or a nonprofit or something else because that just is going to be much more fulfilling. In this case, we're losing a whole generation of people who really are, I think, much more creative about what those solutions could be to those consistent, persistent problems that we have. And now we've just decided to live with those problems.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Syracuse University professor Sean O'Keefe. All right, so the Democratic presidential field, it's now beginning to winnow a bit. Has anything on that side of the political equation particularly surprised or struck you so far?
No, in so many ways, it is, you know, the same large field of candidates, you know, that we saw in the 2016 race, only with the opposite party. And but you're getting everything from soup to nuts here in terms of, you know, your
maybe
choice.
Maybe not literally. Yeah.
Figure of speech that may have gone wrong. It's more you're getting a wide range of selections here of what the political disposition, you know, should be of any individual candidate. But I don't. It's beginning to thin out, but I think it's starting to clarify a bit in terms of where the individual factions are going to be represented and how these really primaries are going to make a big difference moving forward. So there's not a lot of sameness in this group, that's for sure, and nor was there previously in 2016. So we're seeing the same kind of results of this, so it's going to be a pick'em, you know, determination of how it comes out.
So we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to get into this last general topic, tap your thoughts about this. It's a question about where we are kind of politically more generally. Politics has always been rough and tumble, nothing new about that. But in recent decades, I think especially the last 4 years, but prior to that too, it has become particularly polarized, very uncooperative, downright nasty. And political scientists have identified dozens of long and short-term causes for this. I just wanted to get your impression on a couple things. First, is that problem the worst you've seen in your lifetime? And are we at the worst point in your experience?
I've never seen anything even remotely like this in my time in service. And it was – there were many, many challenging, very difficult, you know, circumstances that we worked through and I witnessed as part of either a member of the administration or, for that matter, my prior, you know, time before those appointments was working on Capitol Hill in the Senate, dealing with many members of the administration working through these things. And this is the most polarizing I've ever seen it. And matter of fact, there was a mindset in most of the time that I was privileged to serve in which you absolutely needed folks from the other side of the argument to align with some of the issues you were working through in order to achieve their enactment success. If the view is that this is all about caucuses, the party political affiliation, then that's going to ebb and flow each time the majority shifts. Whereas the activist effort to try to develop coalitions of the willing and like-minded, if you will, regardless of party and their affiliation, that has a strength that will last a considerable period of time. And it did. In many of the occasions and solutions that we were able to reach on a variety of very thorny problems, it had, you know, a combination of not only the majority view but also the minority view.
So let me squeeze one last question in. We've only got a minute, even less. How do we find our way out of this in under a minute? What's the solution?
At the stage in which we as a public come to the conclusion that this is simply, you know, you're going to be up one day and then dramatically down the next by this particular constant polarization, that's the stage in which in every element and chapter in our history, we have seen the politics dig its way out of that problem.
Mm.
And I think we're on the verge of that. We're getting close. At least kind of hope we are.
Well, that's a hopeful note, and that's probably a good place then to let the conversation end. That was Sean O'Keefe. Sean, first of all, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me, but also I want to thank you for your many services to the nation and your career.
Well, thank you, Grant. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Associate producers include Sarah Forland and Zane Aga. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit us online at wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations or download the show as a podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.